I always knew we did well by her. Now you see the result. The dew turned to frost, and that winter we had two kinds of weddings, American and Chinese. For the American part, Miss Grutoff gave me a long white dress she had made for her own wedding but never wore. Her sweetheart died in the Great War, so it was a bad luck dress. But she had such happy tears when she gave me the gown. How could I refuse? For the Chinese banquet, I wore a red wedding skirt and the headscarf that Gao Ling had embroidered. Since Gao Ling had already told mother and father I was to be married, I invited them out of politeness. I hoped they would use the convenient excuse of war not to come. But mother and father did come, as did the aunts and uncles, big and little cousins, nephews and nieces. No one talked about the great embarrassment of what they all knew. It was very awkward. I introduced mother and father as my aunt and uncle, which would have been a true fact if I had not been a love child without proper claim to any family. And most everyone at the school acted politely toward them. Sister Yu, however, gave them critical stares. She muttered to Gao Ling, loud enough for mother to hear. They threw her away, and now they stuff their mouths at her table. All day long, I felt confused, happy in love, angry with my family, yet strangely glad that they were there. And I was also worried about the white wedding dress, thinking this was a sign that my happiness would not last for long. Only two of the scientists, Dong and Chao, came to our party. Because of the war, it was too dangerous for anyone to work in the quarry anymore. Most of the scientists had fled for Peking, leaving behind almost everything except the relics of the past. 26 of the local workers stayed, as did Kai Jing, Dong, and Chao, who also lived on the former monastery grounds. Someone needed to keep an eye on the quarry, Kai Jing reasoned. What if the Japanese decided to blow up the hill? What if the communists used the quarry as a machine gun trench? Even if they used it as an open pit toilet, I said to him, how can you stop them? I was not arguing that he and I should run to Peking as well. I knew he would never separate from his old father, and his old father would never separate from the school and the orphan girls. But I did not want my husband to go into the quarry as hero and come out as martyr. So much was uncertain. So many had already gone away, and many of us felt left behind. As a result, our wedding banquet was like the celebration of a sad victory. After the banquet, the students and friends carried us to our bedchamber. It was the same storeroom where Kai Jing and I had gone for that disaster of a first night. But now the place was clean. No rats, no urine, no ticks or straw. The week before, the students had painted the walls yellow, the beams red. They had pushed the statues to one side. And to keep the three wise men from watching us, I had made a partition of ropes and cloths. On our wedding night, the students remained outside our door for many hours, joking and teasing, laughing and setting off firecrackers. Finally, they tired and left, and for the first time, Kai Jing and I were alone as husband and wife. That night, nothing was forbidden, and our joy was effortless. The next day, we were supposed to visit the houses of our in-laws, so we went to the two rooms at the other end of the corridor where Teacher Pan lived. I bowed and served him tea, calling him Baba, and we all laughed over this formality. Then Kai Jing and I went to the little altar I had made with the picture of precious auntie in a frame. We poured tea for her as well, then lighted the incense, and Kai Jing called her Mama and promised he would take care of my entire family, including the ancestors who had come before me. "I am your family now, too," he said. All at once, a cold breath poured down my neck. Why? I thought of our ancestor who died in the monkey's jaw. Was that the reason? I remember the bones that were never brought back, the curse. What was the meaning of this memory? There are no such thing as curses, Kai Jing later told me. Those are superstitions, and a superstition is a needless fear. The only curses are worries you can't get rid of. But precious auntie told me this, and she was very smart. She was self-taught, exposed to only the old ideas. She had no chance to learn about science, to go to a university like me. Then why did my father die? Why did precious auntie die? Your father died because of an accident. Precious Auntie killed herself. You'd said so yourself. But why did the way of heaven lead to these things? It's not the way of heaven. There is no reason. Because I loved my husband very much, I tried to abide by the new idea. No curses, no bad luck, no good luck either. When I worried over dark clouds, I said there was no reason. When wind and water changed places, I tried to convince myself that there was no reason for this as well. For a while, I had a happy life, not too many worries. Every evening after dinner, Kai Jing and I paid a visit to his father. I loved to sit in his rooms, knowing this was my family home too. The furnishings were plain, old, and honest, and everything had its place and purpose. Against the west wall, Teacher Pan had placed a cushioned bench that was his bed, and above that, he had hung three scrolls of calligraphy, 100 characters each, as if done in one breath, one inspiration. By the south-facing window, he kept a pot of flowers in season, bright color that drew the eye away from shadows. Against the east wall were a simple desk and a chair of dark, polished wood, a good place for thought. And on the desk were precious scholar objects arranged like a still-life painting. A lacquered leather box, ivory brush holders, and an inkstone of Duan, the best kind of stone, his most valuable possession, a gift from an old missionary who had taught him in his boyhood. One night, Teacher Pan gave me that Duan inkstone. I was about to protest, but then I realized that he was my father now, and I could accept it openly with my heart. I held that circle of Duan and ran my fingers over its silky smoothness. I had admired that inkstone since the days when I first came to the school as his helper. He had brought it to class once to show to the students. When you grind ink against stone, you change its character, from ungiving to giving, from a single hard form to many flowing forms. But once you put the ink to paper, it becomes unforgiving again. You can't change it back. If you make a mistake, the only remedy is to throw away the whole thing. Precious Auntie had once said words that were similar. You should think about your character. Know where you're changing, how you will be changed, what cannot be changed back again. She said that when I first learned to grind ink. She also said this when she was angry with me, during the last days we were together. And when I heard Teacher Pan talking about this same thing, I promised myself I would change and become a better daughter. Much had changed, and I wish Precious Auntie could see how good my life was. I was a teacher and a married woman. I had both a husband and a father, and they were good people, and like Gao Ling's in-laws, the Changs. My new family was genuine and sincere to others, the same inside as they showed outside. Precious Auntie had taught me that was important. Good manners are not enough, she had said. They're not the same as a good heart. Though Precious Auntie had been gone for all these years, I still heard her words, in happy and sad times, when it was important. After the Japanese attacked the mouth of the mountain, Gao Ling and I climbed to the hilltop whenever we heard distant gunfire. We looked for the direction of the puffs of smoke. We noticed which way the carts and trucks were moving along the roads. Gao Ling joked that we brought news faster than the ham radio that Kai Jing and Miss Grutov sat in front of for half the day, hoping to hear a word from the scientists who had gone to Peking. I did not understand why they wanted the radio to talk back to them. It spoke only about bad things, which port city was taken, how nearly everyone in this or that town was killed to teach the dead people a lesson not to fight against the Japanese. The Japanese won't win here, Gao Ling would say in the evenings. They may be fast in the sea, but here in the mountains they're like fish flopping on the sand. Our men, on the other hand, are like goats. Every night she said this to convince herself it was true, and for a while it was true. The Japanese soldiers could not push their way up the mountain. While water couldn't run uphill, money did. All kinds of vendors from down below sneaked past the barricades and brought their goods up the mountain so that people from the hill towns could spend their money before they were killed. Gao Ling, Kai Jing, and I would walk along the ridge road to buy luxuries. Sometimes I filled my tin with shaobing, the savory flaky buns coated with sesame seeds that I knew Teacher Pan loved so much. Other days I bought fried peanuts, dried mushrooms, or candied melon. There were many shortages during wartime, so any delicacies we could find were always an excuse for little parties. We held them in Teacher Pan's sitting room. Gao Ling and Sister Yu always joined us, as did the scientists. Dong, the older man with a gentle smile, and Chao, the tall young one whose thick hair hung in front of his face. When we were pouring the tea, Teacher Pan would wind his phonograph. And as we savored our treats, we listened to a song by Rachmaninoff called Oriental Dance. I can still see Teacher Pan waving his hand like a conductor, telling the invisible pianist and the cello players where to quiet down, where to come back with full feeling. At the end of the party, he would lie on a cushioned bench, close his eyes, and sigh, grateful for the food, Rachmaninoff, his son, his daughter-in-law, his dear old friends. "This is the truest meaning of happiness," he would tell us. Then Kai Jing and I would go for an evening stroll before we returned to our own room, grateful ourselves for the joy that exists only between two people. Those were the small rituals we had. What comforted us, what we loved, what we could look forward to, what we could be thankful for and remember afterward. Even in wartime and poverty, people must have plays and opera. "They are the speech and the music of the soul," Kai Jing told me. Every Sunday afternoon, the students performed for us, and they were very enthusiastic. But to be honest, the acting and the music were not very good, painful sometimes to listen to and see, and we had to be very good actors ourselves to pretend this was enjoyment beyond compare. Teacher Pan told me that the plays were just as bad when I was a student and performed in them. How long ago that seemed. Now Miss Towler was bent over with old age, almost as short as Sister Yu. When she played the piano, her nose nearly touched the keys. Teacher Pan had cataracts and worried that soon he would not be able to paint anymore. When winter came, we heard that many of the communist soldiers were falling sick and dying of diseases before they had a chance to fire a single bullet. The Japanese had more medicine, warmer clothes, and they took food and supplies from whatever villages they occupied. With fewer communist troops to defend the hills, the Japanese were crawling up, and with each step, they chopped down trees so no one could hide and escape. Because they were coming closer, we could no longer safely walk the ridge road to buy food. Yet Kai Jing and his colleagues still went to the quarry, and this made me crazy with anxiety. "Don't go," I always begged him. "Those old bones have been there for a million years. They can wait until after the war." That quarry was the only reason we had arguments, and sometimes, when I remember this, I think I should have argued more, argued until he stopped going. Then I think, no, I should have argued less, or not at all. Then maybe his last memories of me would not have been those of a complaining wife. When Kai Jin was not at the quarry, he taught the girls in my class about geology. He told them stories about ancient earth and ancient man, and I listened too. He drew pictures on the chalkboard of icy floods and fiery explosions from underneath, of the skull of Peking Man, and how it was different from a monkey's. Higher in the forehead, more room for his changing brain. If Miss Towler or Miss Grutoff were listening, Kai Jing did not draw the monkey or talk about the ages of the earth. He knew that his ideas about life before and everlasting were different from theirs. One day, Kai Jing told the girls how humans grew to be different from monkeys. "Ancient Peking Man could stand up and walk. We see this by the way his bones are formed, and footprints he left in the mud. He used tools. We see this by the bones and rocks he shaped to cut and smash. And Peking Man probably also began to speak in words. At least his brain was capable of forming a language." A girl asked, "What words? Were they Chinese?" "We don't know for certain," Kai Jin said, "because you cannot leave behind spoken words. There was no writing in those days. That happened only thousands of years ago. But if there was a language, it was an ancient one that likely existed only in that time. And we can only guess what Peking Man tried to say. What does a person need to say? What man, woman, or child does he need to say it to? What do you think was the very first sound to become a word, a meaning. I think a person should always say her prayers to God, another girl said. She should say thank you to those who are nice to her. That night, when Kaijing was already asleep, I was still thinking about these questions. I imagined two people without words, unable to speak to each other. I imagined the need. The color of the sky that meant storm. The smell of fire that meant flee. The sound of a tiger about to pounce. Who would worry about such things? And then I realized what the first word must have been. Ma, the sound of a baby smacking its lips in search of her mother's breast. For a long time, that was the only word the baby needed. Ma, ma, ma. Then the mother decided that was her name, and she began to speak too. She taught the baby to be careful. Sky, fire, tiger. A mother is always the beginning. She is how things begin. One spring afternoon, the students were performing a play. I remember it well. A scene from The Merchant of Venice, which Miss Towler had translated into Chinese. Fall down on your knees and pray, they were chanting. And right then, my life changed. Teacher Pan burst into the hall, panting and shouting. They've seized them. Between broken breaths, he told us that Kaijing and his friends had gone to the quarry for their usual inspection. Teacher Pan had gone along for the fresh air and small talk. At the quarry, they found soldiers waiting. They were communists, and since they were not Japanese, the men were not concerned. The leader of the soldiers approached them. He asked Kaijing, "Hey, why haven't you joined us?" "We are scientists, not soldiers," Kaijing explained. He started to tell them about the work with Peking Man, but one of the soldiers cut him off. "No work has been going on here in months." "If you've worked to preserve the past," the leader said, trying to be more cordial, "surely you can work to create the future. Besides, what past will you save if the Japanese destroy China?" "It's your duty to join us," another soldier grumbled. "Here we are spilling our own blood to protect your damn village." The leader waited for him to be quiet. He turned to Kaijing. "We're asking all men in the villages we defend to help us. You don't need to fight. You can cook or clean or do repairs." When no one said anything, he added in a less friendly voice, "This isn't a request. It's a requirement. Your village owes us this. We order you. If you don't come along as patriots, we'll take you as cowards." It happened that quickly, Teacher Pan said. The soldiers would have taken him as well, but they decided that an old man who was nearly blind was more trouble than help. As the soldiers led the men away, Teacher Pan called out, "How long will they be gone?" "You tell me, comrade," the leader said. "How long will it take to drive out the Japanese?" Over the next 2 months, I grew thin. Gaoling had to force me to eat, and even then I could not taste anything. I could not stop thinking of the curse from the monkey's jaw, and I told Gaoling this, though no one else. Sister Yu held praying for a miracle meetings, asking that the communists defeat the Japanese soon so that Kaijing, Dong, and Chao could return to us quickly. And Teacher Pan wandered the courtyards, his eyes misty with cataracts. Miss Grutoff and Miss Towler would not allow the girls to go outside the compound anymore, even though the fighting took place in other areas of the hills. They had heard terrible stories of Japanese soldiers raping girls. They found a large American flag and hung this over the gateway, as if this were a charm that would protect them from evil. 2 months after the men disappeared, Sister Yu's prayers were half answered. 3 men walked through the gateway early in the morning, and Miss Grutoff beat the gong of the Buddha's ear. Soon everyone was shouting that Kaijing, Dong, and Chao had returned. I ran so fast across the courtyard I tripped and nearly broke my ankle. Kaijing and I grabbed each other and gave in to happy sobs. His face was thinner and very brown. His hair and skin smelled of smoke, and his eyes, they were different. I remember thinking that at the time. They were faded. And now I think some part of his life force had already gone. "The Japanese now occupy the hills," he told us. "They drove off our troops. That was how Sister Yu learned that the other half of her miracle prayer had not come true. They'll come looking for us. I heated water, made a bath, and washed his body with a cloth as he sat in the narrow wooden tub. And then we went to our bedchamber, and I pinned a cloth over the lattice window so it would be dark. We laid down, and as he rocked me, he talked to me in soft murmurs, and it took all of my senses to realize that I was in his arms, that his eyes were looking at mine. "There is no curse," he said. I was listening hard, trying to believe that I would always hear him speak. "And you're brave. You're strong," he went on. I wanted to protest that I didn't want to be strong, but I was crying too much to speak. "You cannot change this," he said. "This is your character." He kissed my eyes, one at a time. "This is beauty, and this is beauty, and you are beauty, and love is beauty, and we are beauty. We are divine, unchanged by time." He said this until I promised I believed him, until I agreed it was enough. The Japanese came for Kaijing Dong and Chow that evening. Miss Grutoff was brave and declared that she was an American and they had no right to enter the orphanage. They paid no attention to her, and when they started to walk toward the rooms where the girls were hiding under their beds, Kaijing and the other men came forward and said they did not need to look any further. I tried to follow. A few days later, I heard wailing in the main hall. When Gaoling came to me with red eyes, I stopped her from saying what I already knew. For a month more, I tried to keep Kaijing alive in my heart and mind. For a while longer, I tried so much to believe what he said. "There is no curse." And then finally, I let Gaojing say the words. Two Japanese officers questioned the men day and night, tried to force them to say where the communist troops had gone. On the third day, they lined them up, Kaijing, Dong, and Chow, as well as 30 other villagers. A soldier stood nearby with a bayonet. The Japanese officer said he would ask them once again, one at a time, and one by one they shook their heads. One by one they fell. In my mind, sometimes Kaijing was first, sometimes he was last, sometimes he was in between. I was not there when this happened, yet I saw it. The only way I could push it out of my mind was to go into my memory. And there in that safe place, I was with him, and he was kissing me when he told me, "We are divine, unchanged by time." Character. Gaoling said the Japanese would soon come for all of us, so I should not bother to kill myself right away. Why not wait and die together? Less lonely that way. Teacher Pan said I should not leave him for the other world. Otherwise, who would he have left as family to give him comfort in his last days? Miss Grutoff said the children needed me to be an inspiration of what an orphan girl could become. If they knew I had given up hope, then what hope could they have? But if it was Sister Yu who gave me the reason to stay alive and suffer on earth. Kaijing, she said, had gone to the Christian heaven. And if I did suicide, I would be forbidden by God to go see him. To me, the Christian heaven was like America, a land that was far away, filled with foreigners, and ruled by their laws. Suicide was not allowed. So I stayed and waited for the Japanese to come back and get me. I visited Teacher Pan and brought him good things to eat. And every afternoon, I walked outside the school to the part of the hillside with many piles of rocks. That was where the missionaries buried the babies and girls who had died over the years. That was where Kaijing lay as well. In our room, I found a few dragon bones he had dug up in the last few months. They were nothing too valuable, just those of old animals. I picked up one and with a thick needle carved words into it to make an oracle bone like the one Precious Auntie had given me. I wrote, "You are beauty. We are beauty. We are divine, unchanged by time." When I finally finished one, I began another, unable to stop. Those were the words I wanted to remember. Those were the morsels of grief I ate. I put those oracle bones at Kaijing's grave. "Kaijing, I said each time I placed them there. Do you miss me? And after a long silence, I told him what had happened that day. Who was sick, who was smart, how he had no more medicine, how it was too bad he wasn't there to teach the girls more about geology. One day I had to tell him that Miss Towler had not awakened in the morning, and soon she would be lying next to him. She went gently to God, Miss Grutoff had said at breakfast, and she acted glad that it was this way. But then she clamped her mouth shut and two deep lines grew down the sides, so I knew she was pitifully sad. To Miss Grutoff, Miss Towler had been mother, sister, and oldest friend. After Miss Towler's death, Miss Grutoff began to make American flags. I think she made those flags for the same reason I made oracle bones for Kai Jing's grave. She was saving some memory, afraid of forgetting. Every day she would sew a star or a stripe. She would dye scraps of cloth red or blue. She had the girls in the school make flags as well. Soon there were 50 flags waving along the outside wall of the old monastery building. Then 100, 200. If a person did not know this was an orphanage for Chinese girls, he would think many, many Americans were inside having a patriotic party. One cold morning, Japanese soldiers finally flocked onto the grounds. We were in the main hall for Sunday worship, although it was not Sunday. We heard gun sounds. Pow, pow. We ran to the door and saw Cook and his wife lying face down in the dirt, and the chickens squabbling nearby, pecking at the bucket of grain that had tipped over. The big American flag that used to hang over the gateway was now lying on the ground. The girls began to cry, thinking that the cook and his wife were dead. But then we saw Cook move a little, turn his head to the side, carefully looking to see who was around them. Miss Grutoff pushed past us to the front. I think we all wondered if she would order the Japanese soldiers to leave us alone, since she was an American. Instead, she asked us to be quiet. No one moved or talked after that. And then we watched, hands covering our mouths to keep from screaming, as the Japanese soldiers shot down the rest of those hundreds of flags, pow, 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 taking turns, criticizing if anyone missed. When all the flags were in pieces, they began to shoot at the chickens, which flapped and squawked and fell to earth. Finally, they took the dead chickens and left. Cook and his wife stood up. The remaining chickens clucked quietly, and the girls let out the wails they had kept locked inside. Miss Grutoff asked everyone to return to the main hall. There she informed us in a shaky voice what she had learned on the ham and shortwave radio several days before. Japan had attacked the United States, and the Americans had declared war on Japan. With America on our side, now China will be able to win the war more quickly, she said, and she led us to join her in clapping. To please her, we smiled to pretend we believed this good news. Later that night, when the girls had gone to their rooms, Miss Grutoff told the teachers and the cook and his wife what else she had heard from her friends at Peking Union Medical College. The bones of Peking men are lost. Destroyed? Teacher Pan asked. No one knows. They've disappeared. All pieces of 41 ancient people. They were supposed to be taken by train to be loaded onto an American boat sailing from Tianjin to Manila, but the ship was sunk. Some say the boxes were never loaded onto the boat. They say the Japanese stopped the trains. They thought the boxes contained only the possessions of American soldiers, so they threw them on the tracks to let them get smashed by the other trains. Now no one knows what to think. It's not good either way. As I listened, I felt my own bones grow hollow. All of Kai Jing's work, his sacrifice, his last trip to the quarry. All was for nothing. I imagined those little pieces of skulls floating among the fish in the harbor, sinking slowly to the bottom, sea eels swimming over them, covering them with sand. I saw other fragments of bones thrown off the train like garbage, the tires of army trucks crushing them until the pieces were no bigger than grains of Gobi sand. I felt as if those bones were Kai Jing's. The next day, the Japanese returned to take Miss Grutov to a prisoner of war camp. She had known this would happen, and yet she had not tried to escape. "I would never willingly leave my girls," she told us. Her suitcases were already packed, and she was wearing her travel hat with a scarf that wrapped around her neck. 56 weeping girls stood at the gate to say goodbye. "Teacher Pan, don't forget the lessons of the apostles," she called out, just before she was boarded the back of the truck. "And please be sure to tell the others so they can pass on the good word." I thought it was a strange farewell. So did the others, until Teacher Pan showed us what she meant. He took us to the main hall, to the statue of an apostle. He twisted off its hand. Inside was a hole that he and Miss Grutov had carved out, where they had hidden silver, gold, and a list of names of former students in Peking. For the past month, he and Miss Grutov had been doing this, late at night. Each apostle had only part of her personal savings, so if the Japanese found money in one, as heathens, they might not know which of the hundreds of statues to search to find the rest. If things became dangerous around the orphanage, we were supposed to use the money to take the girls to Peking, four or five at a time. There they could stay with former students and friends of the school. Miss Grutov had already contacted these people, and they agreed that if the time came, they would willingly help us. We needed only to tell them by the ham radio when we were coming. Teacher Pan assigned each of us, teachers, helpers, and four older students, to an apostle for our share of the refugee money. And from the day that Miss Grutov left, Teacher Pan had us practice and memorize which apostle was which, and where the wood had been dug out of its body. I thought it was enough that we recognized which was our own statue, but Sister Yu said, "We should say all the names out loud, then apostle will protect our savings better." I had to say those names so many times they're still in my head. The traitor, Judas, did not have a statue. About 3 months after Miss Grutov left us, Teacher Pan decided it was time for us to go. The Japanese had become angry that the communists were hiding in the hills. They wanted to draw them out by slaughtering people in nearby villages. Sister Yu also told Gao Ling and me that the Japanese were doing unspeakable acts with innocent girls, some as young as 11 or 12. That was what happened in Tianjin, Tongqiao, and Nanking. Those girls they didn't kill afterward try to kill themselves, she added. So we knew what she was saying just by using the frightened parts of our imaginations. Counting four older students who had stayed on through the war, we had 12 chaperones. We radioed Miss Grutov's friends in Peking, who said the city was occupied, and although the situation was calm, we should wait to hear from them. The trains did not always run, and it would not be good for us to be stuck for days waiting at different cities along the way. Teacher Pan determined the order in which the groups would leave. First, the group led by Mother Wang, who could tell us how the journey went. Then those of the four older girls. Then those of Cook's wife, Teacher Wang, Cook, Gao Ling, me, Sister Yu, and last, Teacher Pan. "Why should you be last?" I asked him. "I know how to use the radio." "You can teach me just as easily." "And me," said Teacher Yu and Gao Ling. We argued, taking turns at being brave. And to do that, we had to be a little unkind and criticize each other. Teacher Pan's eyes were too poor for him to be left alone. Sister Yu was too deaf. Gao Ling had bad feet and a fear of ghosts that made her run the wrong way. Plenty was wrong with me as well, but in the end, I was allowed to go last, so I could visit Kai Jing's grave as long as possible. And now I can confess how scared I was those last few days. I was responsible for four girls, 6 years, 8, 9, and 12. And while it was still comforting to think about killing myself, it made me nervous to wait to be killed. As each group of girls left, the orphanage seemed to grow larger, and the remaining footsteps louder. I was afraid the Japanese soldiers would come and find the ham radio, then accuse me of being a spy and torture me. I rubbed dirt on the girls' faces and told them that if Japanese came, they should scratch their heads and skin pretending to have lice. Almost every hour I prayed to Jesus and Buddha, whoever was listening. I lighted incense in front of Precious Auntie's photo. I went to Kaijing's grave and was honest with him about my fears. "Where is my character?" I asked him. "You said I was strong. Where is that strength now?" On the fourth day of our being alone, I heard the message on the radio. "Come quickly. The trains are running." I went to tell the girls, and then I saw a miracle had happened. But whether this came from the Western God or the Chinese ones, I don't know. I was simply thankful that all four girls had swollen eyes, green pus coming out of their corners. They had an eye infection, nothing serious, but it was awful to see. No one would want to touch them. As for myself, I thought quickly and had an idea. I took some of the leftovers of the rice porridge we had eaten that morning and drained off the watery portion and smeared this liquid onto my skin, my cheeks, forehead, neck, and hands so that when it dried I had the leathery, cracked appearance of an old country woman. I put some more of the sticky rice water into a thermos, and to that I added chicken blood. I told the girls to gather all the chicken eggs left in the pans, even the rotten ones, and put them in sacks. Now we were ready to walk down the hill to the railway station. When we were about 100 paces down the road, we saw the first soldier. I slowed my pace and took a sip from the thermos. The soldier remained where he was and stopped us when we reached him. "Where are you going?" he asked. We five looked up and I could see an expression of disgust pass over his face. The girls started to scratch their heads. Before I answered, I coughed into a handkerchief, then folded it so he could see the blood-streaked mucus. "We're going to the market to sell our eggs," I said. We lifted our sacks. "Would you like some as a gift?" He waved us on. When we were a short distance away, I took another sip of the rice water and chicken blood to hold in my mouth. Twice more we were stopped. Twice more I coughed up what looked like the bloody sputum of a woman with tuberculosis. The girls stared with their green, oozing eyes. When we arrived in Peking, I saw from the train window that Gao Ling was there to meet us. She squinted to make sure it was I getting off the train. Slowly she approached, her lips spread in horror. "What happened to you?" she asked. I coughed blood one last time into my handkerchief. "Hiya," she cried, and jumped back. I showed her my thermos of Japanese chase-away juice. And then we began to laugh and couldn't stop. I was crazy happy, delirious with relief. Gao Ling complained. "The whole time I've been worried sick, and you just play jokes." We settled the girls in homes with former students, and over the next few years, some married, some died, some came to visit us as their honorary parents. Gao Ling and I lived in the back rooms of the old ink shop in the pottery glazing district. We had teacher Pan and sister Yu join us. As for Gao Ling's husband, we all hoped he was dead. Of course, it made me angry beyond belief that the Chang family now owned the ink shop. For all those years since Precious Auntie died, I had not had to think about the coffin maker too much. Now he was ordering us to sell more ink, sell it faster. This was the man who killed my grandfather and father, who caused Precious Auntie so much pain she ruined her life. But then I reasoned that if a person wants to strike back, she must be close to the person who must be struck down. I decided to live in the ink shop because it was practical. In the meantime, I thought of ways to get revenge. Luckily, the Chang father did not bother us too much about the business. The ink was selling much, much better than before we came. That was because we used our heads. We saw that not too many people had used for ink sticks and ink cakes anymore. It was wartime. Who had the leisure and calm to sit around and grind ink on an inkstone, meditating over what to write? We also noted that the Chang family had lowered the quality of the ingredients, so the sticks and cakes crumbled more easily. Teacher Pan was the one who suggested we make quick-use ink. We ground up the cheap ink, mixed it with water, and put it in small jars that we bought for almost nothing at a medicine shop that was going out of business. Teacher Pan also turned out to be a very good salesman. He had the manners and writing style of an old scholar, which helped convince customers that the quality of our quick-use ink was excellent, though it was not. To demonstrate it, however, he had to be careful not to write anything that could be interpreted as anti-Japanese or pro-feudal, Christian or communist. This was not easy to do. Once he decided he should simply write about food. There was no danger in that. So he wrote, "Turnips taste best when pickled." But Gauling worried that this would be taken either as a slur against the Japanese or as siding with the Japanese, since turnips were like radishes, and radishes were what the Japanese liked to eat. So then he wrote, "Father, mother, brother, sister." Sister Yu said that this looked like a listing of those who had died, that this was his way of protesting the occupation. It could also be a throwback to Confucian principle of family, Gauling added, a wish to return to the time of emperors. Everything had dangers, the sun, the stars, the directions of the wind, depending on how many worries we each had. Every number, color, and animal had a bad meaning. Every word sounded like another. Eventually, I came up with the best idea for what to write, and it was settled. "Please try our quick ink. It is cheap and easy to use." We suspected that many of the university students who bought our ink were communist revolutionaries, making propaganda posters that would appear on walls in the middle of the night. "Resist together," the posters said. Sister Yu managed the accounts, and she was not too strict when some of the poorer students did not have enough money to pay for the ink. "Pay what you can," she told them. A student should always have enough ink for his studies. Sister Yu also made sure we kept some money for ourselves, without the Chang fathers noticing that anything was missing. When the war ended in 1945, we no longer had to think about secret meanings that could get us in trouble with the Japanese. Firecrackers burst in the streets all day long, and this made everybody nervously happy. Overnight, the lanes grew crowded with vendors of every delicious kind of thing, and fortune tellers with only the best news. Gauling thought this was a good day to ask her fortune, so Sister Yu and I went wandering with her. The fortune teller Gauling chose could write three different words at one time with three different brushes held in one hand. The first brush he put between the tip of his thumb and one finger. The second rested in the web of his thumb. The third was pinched at the bend of his wrist. "Is my husband dead?" Gauling asked him. We were all surprised by her bluntness. We held our breath as the three characters formed at once. "Return, lose, hope." "What does that mean?" Sister Yu said. "For another small offering," the fortune teller answered, "the heaven will allow me to explain." But Gauling said she was satisfied with this answer, and we went on our way. "He's dead," Gauling announced. "Why do you say that?" I asked. "The message could also mean he's not dead." "It clearly says all hope is lost about his returning home," Sister Yu suggested. "Maybe it means he'll return home and we'll lose hope." "Can be," Gauling said, but I could see a crack of doubt running down her forehead. The next afternoon, we were sitting in the courtyard of the shop, enjoying a new sense of ease, when we heard a voice call out, "Hey, I thought you were dead." A man was looking at Gauling. He wore a soldier's uniform. "Why are you here?" Gauling said as she rose from the bench. He sneered. "I live here. This is my house." Then we knew it was Fu Nan. It was the first time I saw the man who might have been my husband. He was large like his father, with a long white nose. Gauling rose and took his bundle and offered him her seat. She treated him extra politely, like an unwanted guest. "What happened to your fingers?" she asked. Both of his little fingers were missing. He seemed confused at first, then laughed. "I'm a damn war hero," he said. He glanced at us. "Who are they?" Gauling gave our names and said what each of us did to run the business. Fu Nan nodded, then gestured towards Sister Yu and said, "We don't need that one anymore. I'll manage the money from now on." "She's my good friend." "Who says?" He glared at Gauling, and when she did not look away, he said, "Oh, still the fierce little viper. Well, you can argue with the new owner of this shop from now on. He arrives tomorrow." He threw down a document covered with red marks of name seals. Garling snatched it. You sold the shop? You had no right. You can't make my family work for someone else. And the debt, why is it now even bigger? What did you do? Gamble the money away? Eat it? Smoke it? Which one? I'm going to sleep now, he said. And when I wake up, I don't want to see that woman with the hunchback. The way she looks makes me nervous. He waved one hand to dismiss any further protests. He left, and soon we smelled the smoke of his opium clouds. Garling began to curse. Teacher Pan sighed. At least the war is over, and we can see if our friends at the medical school might know of rooms where we can squeeze in. I'm not going, Garling said. How could she say this after all she had told me about her husband? You'd stay with that demon? I exclaimed. This is our family's ink shop. I'm not walking away from it. The war is over, and now I'm ready to fight back. I tried to argue, and Teacher Pan patted my arm. Give her time. She'll come to her senses. Sister Yu left that afternoon for the medical school, but soon she returned. Miss Grutov is back, she told us, released from the war camp, but she's very, very sick. The four of us immediately left for the house of another foreigner named Mrs. Riley. When we went in, we saw how thin Miss Grutov had become. We used to joke that foreign women had big udders because of the cow's milk they drank, but now Miss Grutov looked drained, and her color was poor. She insisted on standing up to greet us, and we insist she sit and not bother to be polite with old friends. Loose skin hung from her face and arms. Her once red hair was gray and thin. How are you? We asked. Not bad, she said, cheerful and smiling. As you can see, I'm alive. The Japanese couldn't starve me to death, but the mosquitoes almost had their way with me. Malaria. Two of the girls at the school had had malaria and died, but I did not tell Miss Grutov. There would be plenty of time for bad news later. You must hurry and get well, I said. Then we can reopen the school. Miss Grutov shook her head. The old monastery is gone, destroyed. One of the other missionaries told me. We gasped. The trees, the building, everything had been burned to the ground and scattered. The other foreigner, Miss Riley, nodded. I wanted to ask what had happened to the graves, but I could not speak. I felt as I had that day when I knew Kaijin had been killed. Thinking about him caused me to try to remember his face, but I saw more clearly the stones under which he lay. How long had I loved him when he was alive? How long had I grieved for him since he had died? Miss Riley then said, "We're going to open a school in Peking once we find the building. But now we need to help Miss Grutov get well, don't we, Ruth?" And she patted Miss Grutov's hand. "Anything," we took turns to say. "Of course we'll help. We love Miss Grutov. She is mother and sister to us all. What can we do?" Mrs. Riley then said Miss Grutov had to return to the United States to see the doctors in San Francisco, but she would need a helper to accompany her to Hong Kong and then across the ocean. "Would one of you be willing to go with me? I think we can arrange for a visa." "We can all go," Garling answered at once. Miss Grutov became embarrassed. I could see this. "I wouldn't want to trouble more than one of you," she said. "One is enough, I think." And then she sighed and said she was exhausted. She needed to lie down. When she left the room, we looked at one another, uncertain how to begin the discussion of who should be the one to help Miss Grutov. America? Miss Grutov did not ask this only as a favor. We all knew she was also offering a great opportunity. A visa to America. But only one of us could take it. I thought about this. In my heart, America was the Christian heaven. It was where Kaijing had gone, where he was waiting for me. I knew this was not actually true, but there was a hope that I could find happiness that had stayed hidden from me. I could leave the old curse, my bad background. Then I heard Garling say, "Teacher Pan should go. He's the oldest and the most experienced." She had jumped in with first suggestion, so I knew she wanted to go as well. "Experienced at what?" he asked. "I can't be of much help, I'm afraid. I'm an old man who can't even read or write unless the words are as large and close as my shaky hands. And it would not be proper for a man to accompany a lady. What if she needs help during the night?"
"Sister Yu," Garling said. "You go then. You're smart enough to overcome any obstacle."
Another suggestion. Garling was desperate to go, to have someone argue that it should be her who went.
"If people don't trample me first," Sister Yu said, "don't be ridiculous. Besides, I don't want to leave China. To be frank, while I have Christian love for Miss Grutov and our foreign friends, I don't care to be around other Americans. Civil war or not, I'd rather stay in China."
"Then Lu Ling should go," Garling said. What could I do? I had to argue.
"I could never leave my father-in-law or you."
"No, no, you don't have to keep this old man company," I heard my father-in-law say. "I've been meaning to tell you that I may marry again."
"Yes, me. I know what you're thinking. The gods are laughing, and so am I."
"But who?" I asked. I could not imagine he had any time to court a woman. He was always at the shop, except when he went on brief errands.
"She lives next door to us, the longtime widow of the man who ran the bookshop."
"Wow, the man who sued our family?" Garling said. "The books were fake," I reminded her. "The man lost the lawsuit, remember?"
And then we remembered our manners and congratulated Teacher Pan by asking if she was a good cook, if she had a pleasant face, a kind voice, a family that was not too much trouble. I was happy for him, but also glad that I no longer had to argue that I could not go to America.
"Well, it's clear to me Lu Ling should be the one to go to America with Miss Grutov," Sister Yu said. "Teacher Pan will soon be bossed around by a new wife, so Lu Ling has less need to stay."
Garling hesitated a moment too long before saying, "Yes, that's the best. It's settled then."
"What do you mean?" I said, trying to be big-hearted. "I can't leave my own sister."
"I'm not even your real sister," Garling said.
"You go first. Later you can sponsor me."
"Ah, see? That means you want to go."
I could not help rubbing it in, but now that everything had been decided, I felt I could safely do this.
"I didn't say that," Garling said. "I meant only if things change and later I need to come. Why don't you go first, and later you can sponsor me? If you stay, that husband of yours will put you under his thumb and grind you to pieces."
I was really being generous.
"But I can't leave my sister any more than she can leave me," Garling said.
"Don't argue," I told her. "I'm older than you. You go first. Then I'll go to Hong Kong in a month or so and wait for the sponsorship papers to come through."
Garling was supposed to argue that she should be the one to wait in Hong Kong, but instead she asked,
"Is that how long it takes to sponsor another person? Only 1 month?"
And though I had no idea how long it took, I said,
"Maybe it's even quicker than that."
I still thought she was going to agree to wait.
"That fast?" Garling marveled. "Well, if it's that quick, I might as well go first, but only so I can leave that demon of a husband right away."
Just then, Mrs. Riley came back to the room.
"We've agreed," Sister Yu announced. "Garling will accompany Miss Grutov to San Francisco."
I was too stunned to say anything. That night, I went over in my head how I had lost my chance. I was angry that Garling had tricked me. Then I had sisterly feelings and was glad she was going so she could get away from Funan. Back and forth I went between these two feelings. Before I fell asleep, I decided this was fate. Now whatever happened, that was my new destiny. 3 days later, just before we left for Hong Kong, we had a little party.
"There's no need for tears and goodbyes," I said. "Once we're settled in the new country, we'll invite you all to come visit."
Teacher Pan said that he and his new wife would enjoy that very much, a chance to visit another country before their life was over.
Sister Yu said she had heard much about dancing in America. She confessed that she had always wanted to learn how to dance.
And for the rest of the evening, which was the last time we ever saw them, we took turns guessing and joking. Miss Grutov would be healed, then come back to China, where she would make more orphan girls acting more bad plays. Galling would be rich, having finally found the right fortune teller, one who could write with four brushes at once. And I would be a famous painter. We toasted one another. Soon, maybe in a year or less, Sister Yu and Teacher Pan with his new wife would sail to America for a holiday. Galling and I would come to the harbor in San Francisco and wait for them in our new automobile, a shiny black one with many comfortable seats and an American driver. Before we drove them to our mansion on top of a hill, we would stop at a ballroom. And to celebrate our reunion, we all agreed we would dance and dance and dance. Fragrance. Each night when I returned to the rooming house in Hong Kong, I lay on a cot with wet towels over my chest. The walls were sweating because I couldn't open the windows for fresh air. The building was on a fishy street on the Kowloon side. This was not the part where the fish were sold. There it smelled of morning sea, salty and sharp. I was living in Kowloon Walled City, along the low point in a wide gutter, where the scales and blood and guts gathered, swept there by the fishmongers' buckets of water at night. When I breathed there, it was the vapors of death, a choking sour stink that reached like fingers into my stomach and pulled my insides out. Forever in my nose, that is the fragrance of Fragrant Harbor. The British and other foreigners lived on the Hong Kong Island side, but in Kowloon Walled City, it was almost all Chinese. Rich and raggedy, poor and powerful, everyone different, but we all had this in common. We had been strong, we had been weak, we had been desperate enough to leave behind our motherland and the families. And there were also those who made money from people's despair. I went to many blind seers, the Wen Ni Po who claimed they were ghostwriters. I have a message from a baby, they called, a message from a son, a husband, an ancestor who is angry. I sat down with one, and she told me, "Your precious auntie has already been reincarnated. Go 3 blocks east, then 3 blocks north. A beggar girl will cry out to you, 'Auntie, have pity, give me hope.' Then you will know it is she. Give her a coin, and the curse will be ended." I did exactly as she said, and on that exact block, a girl said those exact words. I was so overjoyed. Then another girl said those words. Another and another, 10, 20, 30 little girls, all without hope. I gave them coins, just in case. And for each of them, I felt pity. The next day, I saw another blind lady who could talk to ghosts. She also told me where to find precious auntie. Go here, go there. The next day was the same. I was using up my savings, but I didn't think it mattered. Soon, any day now, I would leave for America. After I had lived a month in Hong Kong, I received a letter from Galling. "My own true sister, forgive me for not writing you sooner. Teacher Pan sent your address to me, but I did not receive it right away, because I was moving from one church lady's house to another. I'm also sorry to tell you that Miss Grutov died a week after we arrived. Right before she flew to heaven, she said she made a mistake coming back to America. She wanted to return to China so her bones could rest there, next to Miss Towler's. I was glad to know how much she loved China, and sorry because it was too late to send her back. I went to her funeral, but not too many people knew her. I was the only one who cried, and I said to myself, she was a great lady. My other news is not so good either. I learned I cannot sponsor you, not yet. The truth is, I almost was not able to stay myself. Why we thought it would be so easy, I don't know. I see now we were foolish. We should have asked many more questions. But now I have asked questions, and I know of several ways for you to come later. How much later depends. One way is for you to apply as a refugee. The quota for Chinese, however, is very low, and the number who want to get in is beyond count. To be honest, your chances are like a leak moving against a flood. Another way is for me to be a citizen first so I can sponsor you as my sister. You will have to claim that mother and father are your real mother and father, since I cannot sponsor a cousin. But as a relative, you would be in a different line, ahead of ordinary refugees. For me to become a citizen, however, means I have to learn English first and get a good job. I promise you I'm studying very hard, in case this is the means I have to turn to. There is a third way. I can marry a citizen and then become a citizen faster. Of course, it is inconvenient that I'm already married to Chang Funan, but I think no one needs to know this. On my visa papers, I did not mention it. Also, you should know that when I applied for the visa man asked for documents as proof of my birth, and I said, "Who has documents of such things?" He said, "Oh, were they burned during the war like everyone else's?" I thought that was the correct answer, so I agreed it was true. When you prepare your visa papers, you must say the same thing. Also, make yourself 5 years younger, born 1921. I already did, born 1922, but in the same month as the old birthday. This will give you extra time to catch up. Mother and father have already written to ask me to send them my extra money. I have had to write back to say I have none. If I do in the future, of course, I will send some to you. I feel so guilty that you insisted I come first, and I gave in to your demands. Now it is you who are stuck, not knowing what to do. Don't mistake my meaning. Life here is not so easy, and making money is not like what we imagined. All those stories of instant riches, don't believe them. As for dancing, that is only in the movies. Most of the day, I clean houses. I'm paid 25 cents. That may sound like a lot, but it costs that much to eat dinner. So it is hard to save money. For you, of course, I'm willing to starve. In his last letter, Father said he almost died of anger when he learned that Funan lost the ink business in Peking. He said Funan has returned to Immortal Heart and is lying around useless, but the Chang father is not being critical. Saying Funan is a big war hero, lost two fingers, saved lives. You know what I was thinking when I read that. Most terrible of all, our family still has to supply ink sticks and ink cakes, and we receive none of the profit, only a lesser debt. Everyone has to take on various home businesses, weaving baskets, mending, do menial labor that makes mother complain that we have fallen as low as the tenants. She asks me to hurry and become rich so I can pull her out of the bowels of hell. I feel a great burden of guilt and responsibility. When I finished reading Gao Ling's letter, I felt as if an axe were chopping my neck when I was already dead. I had waited in Hong Kong for nothing. I could wait a year, 10 years, or the rest of my life in this crowded city among desperate people with stories sadder than mine. I knew no one, and I was lonely for my friends. There was no America for me. I had lost my chance. The next day, I gathered my things and went to the train station to return to Peking. I put down my remaining money at the ticket booth. "The fare is higher now, miss," said the ticket man. "How could this be?" "Money is worth less now," he told me. "Everything costs more." I then asked for a lower class ticket. "That's the lowest," he said, and pointed to the wall with fares written on the blackboard. Now I was stuck. I wondered if I should write to Teacher Pan or perhaps Sister Yu. But then I thought, oh, to give so much trouble to someone. No, you fix this problem yourself. I would pawn my valuables. But when I looked at them, I saw that these were treasures only to me, a notebook of Kai Jing's, a jacket Gao Ling gave me before I went to the orphanage, the pages of Precious Auntie's and her photograph. And there was also the oracle bone. I unwrapped it from its soft cloth and looked at the characters scratched on one side. Unknown words, what should have been remembered? At one time, an oracle bone was worth twice as much as a dragon bone. I took my treasure to three shops. The first belonged to a bone setter. He said the bone was no longer used as medicine, but as a strange curiosity, it was worth a little money. He then offered me a price that surprised me, for it was almost enough to buy a second-class ticket to Peking. The next shop sold jewelry and curios. The shopkeeper took out a magnifying glass. He examined the oracle bone very carefully, turning it several times. He said it was genuine, but not a good example of an oracle bone. He offered me the price of a first-class ticket to Peking. The third place was an antique shop for tourists. Like the jeweler, this man